Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, after a tough few days in the markets, we'll take a look at what's worrying investors right now, from the threat of contagion from problems in the Chinese property market to expectations of reduced stimulus in the US. Is this a blip or something more? That's the focus today. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. September is often a tough month for markets, and this year is proving no exception to that rule. Markets have been moving sideways for a number of weeks before resistance broke in the past few days and indices have begun to fall. The trigger appears to be financial trouble at a giant Chinese property developer called Evergrande, but that only added to more general worries that the withdrawal of stimulus measures in the US could be mapped out this week when Federal Reserve rate setters meet. Is this the start of a more serious correction for markets that some have been predicting, or another buying opportunity? To help answer that, I'm joined by Tom Stevenson, Investment Director here at Fidelity. Tom, welcome along. I don't know about you, but for me, this has been one of those weeks when I've decided to ignore my investment count for a few days. It's been quite choppy out there, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, Ed. You're absolutely right. And isn't that interesting? We tend to look pretty closely at our investment accounts when the market's going up, and we find plenty of reasons not to look at it when it's going down. That's an interesting lesson there, probably. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It has been pretty choppy out there. You mentioned a couple of the issues: Evergrande in China, Federal Reserve in the US, and of course, one thing you didn't mention there, which is closer to home, all these issues around the rising gas price. And you know, at first glance you think, well, that's not really anything to do with the markets, but actually when you look at the sort of knock-on implications of that in terms of businesses in particular, and I've learned lots of things about CO2, for example, that I didn't know a week or so ago. And it's very interesting. It shows how completely interconnected the whole global economy is. And you know, when something goes wrong over here, then things, you know, start to fall apart over there. So yeah, it's an interesting time at the moment, that's for sure.
Yeah, and to bring people right up to speed, I mean, we'll be out of date as soon as this is recorded, Tom, I suppose. But as we speak, I think markets have rebounded a bit from what happened at the end of last week, I guess, and certainly yesterday on Monday. We've had big falls, and let's run through what exactly is eating investors. You've mentioned a few of those things, Tom. Let's start with this Chinese property developer that I'm guessing few people were really aware of before this week, Evergrande. It's heavily indebted, we know that, and now people are worrying whether it can meet its financial commitments. I think it's got bond payments to make in the coming days. Why is that a problem, Tom, not just for investors exposed to Evergrande, but for markets more generally?
Yes, I mean, you know, I must confess, I fall in that camp. You know, a few weeks ago, I'd never even heard of Evergrande, and this is the nature of these things. They creep up on you, and people who are sort of close to it have been worrying about the Chinese property market for a few weeks now. It's only really only this week that it's got on most investors' radars, and that's because it started to have a knock-on impact in markets more generally. And we saw at the beginning of this week a very heavy fall in that company's share price. It's actually down 85% this year, which is telling us something about the prospects for that company. But what we saw was a more generalized fallout in the Chinese real estate sector, and indeed in the Hang Seng, the Hong Kong index more generally, which fell 3.5% yesterday. You're right, we've had a bit of a bounce today, but it did spill through all the markets. You know, it started in Asia yesterday, it rolled over into Europe, and then yesterday Wall Street had its worst day for many months. It was down nearly 3% at one point, actually ended down 1.7% overall. But it's just an indication that something which is apparently over there and Chinese problem, you know, can start to have wider repercussions before you're really aware of it.
I guess in that case, Tom, the issue here is the money maybe that company owes to other people and the other, maybe the other financial institutions that are exposed to it. You hear this word contagion. That's going to have people bristling, because that's, of course, what everyone was worried about back in the financial crisis and in the European debt crisis. This idea that the interlinked nature of financial systems means that, as you say, a problem, a concentrated problem, can soon become a more generalized problem.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, let's just sort of put this in context for people that maybe are not sort of fully up to speed on this story. Evergrande is quite a big deal. We may not have heard of it a few weeks ago, but it is the second biggest property developer in China. It's responsible for something like 1,300 of these big residential projects. We've all seen the pictures of these, you know, massive residential tower blocks. 1,300 of those projects in nearly 300 Chinese cities. Something like 12 million Chinese people live in an Evergrande property. Wow. And as you say, very heavily indebted company. This is a company which has grown through debt over about 25 years. It currently owes more than $300 billion to creditors, and it's struggling to service those debts. And the reason why it's struggling is because the property market is slowing down, and that's the nature of debt. You know, when your revenues slow down, the size of your debt stays the same, and when it's $300 billion plus, that's a major problem.
Yeah, and I guess what's eating the market is that, sure, you've got maybe the sort of direct exposure to that company and the problems that might spill out from that. But it's also, as you say there, it reflects challenges in the Chinese property market. And that's a negative because, I don't know, without being expert on this, it's got to be bad news if lots of property owners in China are suddenly seeing the price of their property fall. That potentially reduces demand in that economy. It's a huge economy. It might reflect problems there and falling demand generally in the world's economy. And obviously, you've got you're seeing declining prices for commodities, things like iron ore. That's affected miners. And so regions like the UK and Australia, which have lots of miners, they've been really feeling it.
Yes, I think that, you know, the ripple effects of something like this are very significant. You know, you think about the Chinese property market, it's a very important part of the Chinese economy generally. I've seen a figure of that it's responsible directly and indirectly for about 25% of the Chinese economy. And that sounds like a very big figure. But when you think that all the related activities like banking, like insurance, the extent to which rising property prices have underpinned consumer spending, and of course, the Chinese economy is attempting to move towards a more consumption-driven market rather than an export and investment driven market. So that has ripple effects. You mentioned commodities there. We've seen a big fall in the iron ore price, and that's related to steel. And of course, steel is highly related to the property market. We saw a 20% fall in the iron ore price last week, and that has had knock-on effects on the commodity producers. So Anglo American, for example, its shares fell by 6% at the open yesterday morning. So yeah, absolutely. The you know, it's difficult to know where this stops, because the ripples do go out from what this apparently, you know, unimportant company on a global scale, but it can have very important knock-on impacts.
Okay, well, if that wasn't enough, Tom, we've also got some longer-running concerns, I guess you could say, and these seem to have resurfaced or peaked in the past week as well. And in particular, we have a two-day meeting of the Federal Reserve that's happening this week. What's the worry there, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, all these, like London buses, isn't it? All these things come along at once. I mean, it's a big week for central banks this week. We've got the Federal Reserve having their rate setting meeting. We've got the Bank of England as well. We've got the Bank of Japan. Now, the common problem there, the common theme running through this is inflation. We've seen in recent months that the inflation rate in America has been persistently high, more than 5%. Last week, or was it the week before, we saw here in the UK a big jump in inflation from 2% to 3.2%. So the central banks have been stimulating the economy. They've arguably been stimulating the economy for the last 12 or 13 years. And, you know, everyone feared a decade ago that this would lead to inflation. It didn't happen for various reasons. It does now seem to be causing some kind of inflation. Now, the question is whether that's persistent or transitory. That the jury remains out on that. But the evidence is shifting towards a feeling that inflation is back here as more of a problem than it has been for many, many years. And that is what central banks are grappling with this week. So what are we going to hear from the Fed this week? Well, we are likely to hear about the first stage in reining back the stimulus, and that is reining back, or tapering as it's called, the spending by the central bank on government bonds. At the moment, it's spending $120 billion every single month buying in bonds to support bond prices and to keep bond yields low, and so to support the economy in that way. At the recent Jackson Hole summit, the chairman of the Fed, Jay Powell, made it clear that both on in terms of inflation and in terms of the job market, the bar is we're reaching the point where that stimulus can be reined back. So I think what we'll hear this week is probably that stimulus is going to start to be reined back in November and throughout next year. Now, that doesn't mean that interest rates are going to go up. That's probably a year or so away. But on that, we'll also hear some important news this week, because when the Fed announces its decisions about interest rates, it periodically publishes what it calls the dot plots. And these are this is a chart which shows the forecasts by individual rate setters of where they think interest rates will be in the years to come. And interestingly, this time, on Wednesday, tomorrow, for the first time, we'll see forecasts for 2024 for interest rates. So we'll get a picture of where the rate setters at the Fed think that interest rates are going. And all the expectations are that we're going to see probably the first rate hike at the end of next year, then maybe three more in 2023, and then maybe three more in 2024. So we are at the beginning, or we're approaching, a proper tightening cycle.
Yeah, and it's important to say here, Tom, that you know, you're talking about long-term forecasts there. The Fed isn't about to just flick a switch overnight, is it? I suppose the first thing that might go is a pulling back of those bond purchases that you talk about. But then, as you say, the forecasts that people are going to be interested in are out to 2024, which is not tomorrow. Now, if they do come to pass and we do get a tightening in the way that people forecast that we might, that will at least mean that the economy has continued to recover, right? I mean, this is always the thing about this equation. Markets hate it, hate the idea that there'll be stimulus withdrawn. But at the same time, the reason that is being withdrawn is because economies are heating up and inflation is obviously coming through, and they believe it's robust enough to be able to take that withdrawal.
Well, yes and no, and I hate to be the sort of the bringer of bad news, but that is partly true. It's partly true if the driver of inflation is economic growth. I think the big fear, and what I'm hearing people talk about, and you know, sort of you know, what investors and strategists talking, they're using a word which they haven't used for many years: stagflation. And what that means is this combination of inflation, which is driven not by growth, but by problems in the supply chains, for example, which we're seeing all around us, and at the same time, a slowdown in growth. Now, that's a really difficult dilemma for central banks, because you know, if growth is rising and inflation is rising, then it's their job to rein it in a bit and to raise rates to do that. If it's a combination of rising inflation and slowing growth, then they don't quite know how to deal with that. And I fear that may be the challenge facing central banks this week and for the months to come.
Okay. Well, let's take a step back, Tom, and ask where we are headed as the summer obviously ends. We've got winter stretching before us. The bad news does seem to be gathering, doesn't it? But as I said right at the start, September is a month when the mood can often darken and change for the worst. Is this a September blip, would you say, or something more? Has this amazing, amazing run in markets that we've seen since the lows after COVID-19, particularly the US market, of course, has that now run out of steam, would you say?
Well, I don't know that I would go so far as to say that it has run out of steam, but I think it is fair to say that the extraordinary V shape of the recovery has run its course, and that we're looking at a more subdued growth rate going forward, probably. And we're seeing that in the sort of the technical measures in the market, and we don't need to go into the details, but there are measures of the market momentum, moving averages.
Yes.
And the indices are starting to sort of test those momentum measures, which is never a good sign for the market. So I think, we may be looking at some kind of a correction. And if we do, do you know what? That's completely normal. That is what markets do, even when they are in a long run bull market. And I think there's a very strong case to be made that we remain in a long bull market. If you look at the bull markets in the post-war period, they've often gone on for much longer than this one, for 20 years or so. So I think there are good reasons to think that we're still in a bull market, but we are going to get corrections. And so if the market were to fall by 10%, I think as investors, we just have to accept that. We have to accept that volatility is the price that we pay for the long-term growth in stock markets. Why do I think we're still in a bull market? I think that in an environment of very low bond yields, which is likely to persist, I think shares continue to offer the best option for investors. Some people call it TINA. There's no alternative. Company profits, I think, are still rising pretty strongly. Looking forward to next year, when things are going to be a bit more back to normal, the comparisons won't be with the pandemic, the worst of the pandemic period. There'll be a more normal comparison. We're still looking at sort of 10% earnings growth. The economy is still growing at sort of 5% next year, according to the forecasts. And I think interest rates are going to remain relatively subdued. And I think, importantly, they're going to remain below the rate of inflation. That's a negative real interest rate, it's called in the jargon. And that tends to be quite good news for shares. And the final point that I would just make, Ed, is that, and we discussed this on many occasions, dipping in and out of the market on fears of a correction is very risky because it involves two decisions. It involves the decision to get out, and it also involves the decision to get back into the market. And the second of those decisions is just as difficult as the first. It's probably more difficult than the first one. And it's why we always encourage people to stick with it through the cycle, because jumping in and out of the market effectively in a way that doesn't damage your long-term returns is very difficult.
Yeah, and well, you preempted my question, Tom, because I was going to ask you about this. I mean, I've been thinking myself, you and I have had all these gloomy conversations, and it's very tempting to think, well, wouldn't it be a smart move to take some money off the table right now, or at least stop, maybe build up a cash pile in case things move more downwards. But I guess, yeah, as you say there's still lots of fundamentals which suggest the stock market is still the place to be.
Yes, and you know what? I think more than that, I think that I have come to realise that I'm just not smart enough to time those moves in and out of the market. When you try and do it, it tends to come back and bite you. You miss the moment, actually, to get out of the market because the mood is still buoyant at the top, and you don't realise that things have turned until they have already turned. And equally, you tend to miss the bottom, sometimes by a very wide margin. It takes quite a few months of the market recovering, sometimes years for many investors, years of the market recovering before you regain the confidence to get back in. That's a very high opportunity cost that you suffer because of your desire to try and time the market. It's so difficult.
Okay. Well, wise words, Tom. That is all that we have time for now. Thanks an awful lot for joining me.
Thanks, Ed.
You've You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds, and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.